And now another no-brainer money-saving tip from Progressive.
Marcus, what happened?
I was changing my oil and I spilled some on the floor.
Oh, well, use these $50 bills to wipe it up.
Perfect. Got any more?
Yeah, take a couple hundred.
Stop. Instead of using money, use an old rag. And here's a better tip from Progressive on how not to waste money. Don't pay too much for car insurance. Drivers who switch and save could save hundreds. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary.
Whether you're looking to build a website for your business, your hobby, your podcast, or just for fun, Pear Networks is your go-to web hosting partner. Not only do we have the lowest domain price in the industry, starting at just $11, we've got hundreds of stunning website templates to help you stand out from the crowd. You're not a techie? Not a problem. With our easy DIY site builders, you can launch your impressive website without any technical know-how. And when it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. Check out pear.com today to learn more. PAIR.com.
News, science, the unexplained, space and the cosmos, exploring our past, our future, and the mysteries of our universe. Taking a critical look at reality and a journey to the edges of human understanding. The future is now. This is Micah Hanks.
From the high mountains of Appalachia in a bunker below ground. Welcome one and all. It is the Micah Hanks Program. Glad, as always, to be getting behind the microphone, getting into gear, and going in pursuit of the enigmatic in our existence and the mysteries of space-time and the cosmos. As we do every week, listen on demand via podcasting apps in every pocket, and of course, our station affiliates at the UnX Radio Network. So let's lock in. Big day for astronomy, for space exploration, really, for humankind, with the James Webb Space Telescope. And the first images it has captured revealed this morning by NASA. I'll have a complete update here in mere moments. And of course, later this year, NASA is also going to be looking at unidentified aerial phenomena. Let's not forget about that. In fact, the editorial board of a paper of record in recent days weighed in on that and said why it's important for them to be doing so. But as always, I've got a lot to say about that topic, which includes new legislation and language to be contained, perhaps, in one of the largest defense bills that goes out every year. What representatives in Washington are saying about this subject. And then later in the program, I'm also going to be joined by a fine gentleman and also a director of fine films, Mr. Randall Nickerson. Randall, of course, is the director of a new documentary that just came out called The Aerial School Phenomenon. And this documents an incident that occurred many moons ago in Zimbabwe that involved a group of school children who said they saw something they couldn't explain. In fact, there were also faculty and staff who saw this, a multiple witness encounter of the uncanny kind. What did it actually entail? Why did Harvard psychologist John Mack travel there and become very involved firsthand in the investigation? We'll talk with Randall about all of that and much more in the moments ahead. As time unfolds like it does every week. In fact, I hope you guys had some time to slow down and enjoy yourselves over the weekend. These days, there's very little time for slowing down, very little time for enjoyment. Friends and family members bickering at me because I never have time. Which reminds me of one of my favorite Doctor Who quotes of all time. I believe it was the Fifth Doctor who had said, "That's the problem with time travel. No one ever seems to be able to find the time." Although maybe in my case, finding the time isn't so much the problem as it is managing what time I have, right? Maybe you guys could give me some tips. Although over the years, I've actually tried some rather novel strategies to maximize my time. I've bought books about speed reading. You know, I read Tim Ferriss's book, The 4-Hour Workweek, a few years back, and I'll tell you, as most people know who've read that book, I don't think there's any such thing as a 4-hour workweek unless maybe you're a volunteer worker and you're actually retired, so you only have to work 4 hours a week. Yeah, if you're actually trying to make ends meet, and you've got limited time and resources, like I do, then you're going to have to really work hard. But if you love what you do, it doesn't always feel like work. Only sometimes, like when I'm working on the weekend. But again, I'm not just talking about my personal schedule here. I'm literally fascinated with time, and longtime listeners know that. And that's part of what was so significant about the big reveal of the first images captured by the James Webb Space Telescope that were revealed by NASA this morning. Because unlike its predecessor, the Hubble Space Telescope, Webb observes our universe in, first of all, striking detail, as these new stunning images reveal. And by the way, they're all available online at NASA's website. I'm sure you're going to be hearing and seeing these everywhere. But if you head on over to thedebrief.org, I've done a complete breakdown where you can find everything, all the images, all the links, all the key points and takeaways from the big reveal today, what the administrator of NASA, Bill Nelson, had to say, and of course, here in a moment, we'll be featuring some audio sound bites about that. But if you want to see these images right now, just scroll down to your show notes in your podcasting app, and I'll have a link right there to our article that I did at thedebrief.org. That'll get you where you got to go and show you everything that everybody is talking about right now, including yours truly. But yes, with the highly advanced and extremely sensitive near-infrared camera systems on board the James Webb Space Telescope, we are able to see not only a different spectra of the light that populates our universe, but we can actually see farther out. And because of that, we're also able to see further back in time. And so what we are able to see with the James Webb Space Telescope right now is effectively time travel in a sense. And many of the astronomers who were talking today spoke to that very fact. The fact that we can see now galaxies in distant reaches of space that, due to the amount of time it actually takes the light produced by those galaxies to reach us, we are effectively seeing those galaxies around the time that they formed or shortly thereafter. We are literally looking back in time at the early stages of the development of our universe. And that, to me, is really one of the trippy things about the way our universe works. I mean, just because you can see it doesn't mean that what you're seeing is actually as it appears. We may not think of that so often here on Earth, where when we look at something, despite the fact that there may be a slight delay, and actually sound is far more delayed than light is, what we see is usually a pretty quick representation, because nothing travels faster in our universe than light, right? But when it comes to sound and the propagation of sound waves through a medium like air, you're going to look at something off in the distance, see it happen first, and if there's, for instance, an explosion or a loud clap or some sort of a noise produced, you don't hear that until much later. And I'll give you a quick example of the way that this actually contributes to certain mysteries about our world, because for years there have been people who have said that when they see a meteor streaking through the sky, they also hear a fizzling kind of sound, which is actually impossible in terms of physics if you think about it. Because if you're seeing the meteor streaking through the atmosphere, the time it would take for that sound to travel to where your eardrums are, miles and miles and miles away, would take, I mean, according to many estimates, as much as 2 minutes. And yet a lot of people over the years have talked about the fact that when they saw a meteor, its appearance was brought to their attention by the sound that it made. Again, physicists say that's impossible. People who've seen this and experienced it say, not impossible, I heard it, then I saw it. So what's going on there? And to me, these are the fascinating things about our universe, and really the dynamics of the physics of our universe, that are so important, that really should remain requisite in terms of trying to get a handle on what's happening around us. And these are all, to me, reasons why it's so important right now, what's happening with the James Webb Space Telescope. We are effectively looking back in time, and we're getting a clearer, more high-definition view of the universe than we have ever gotten at any time before. And of course, although we all got to see these images for the first time this morning, a few people saw them earlier. Some of you guys actually may have been tuning in yesterday evening when they did a special briefing there at the White House, and I'm guessing probably that the President and the Vice President and others there in the Oval Office, they probably got to see all these images. But the folks at NASA did allow the public to see one of these yesterday with commentary from the president. I want to go over to the audio soundbites right now and feature a bit of that commentary. Here's Joe Biden yesterday evening discussing the historic release of these photographs and really what they mean for not just America, but the international community.
As an international collaboration, this telescope embodies how America leads the world, not by the example of our power, but the power of our example. A partnership with others. It symbolizes the relentless spirit of American ingenuity. And it shows what we can achieve, what more we can discover, not just about distant places, but about our very own planet and climate, like NASA's Earth Systems Observatory that we launched last year. That's why the federal government must invest in science and technology more than we have in the past. These images are going to remind the world that America can do big things. And then remind the American people, especially our children, that there's nothing beyond our capacity. Nothing beyond our capacity. We can see possibilities no one has ever seen before.
And indeed, we are seeing some things that we have seen before in the new images released by NASA of the James Webb Space Telescope, although we are seeing them in much greater detail, much more vibrant colors, much greater clarity than what has been seen in years past. To give you an idea of what actually was seen this morning, the first of the images which they featured there at the White House last night was a collection of galaxies, galaxy clusters, and stars. Very impressive, very colorful. But really, again, to look out into space and realize that beyond what the human eye can see and what we experience here on Earth, you know, on a clear night you can see other planets in our solar system, but you look at this image and it gives you an idea of all the other galaxies out there. All the other galaxies, many of them with habitable planets, right, that are encircling suns in solar systems not unlike our own. In fact, I would actually call that first image comparable to the famous pale blue dot image collected by the Voyager probes that Carl Sagan remarked on that reminds us just how small we are here on our little world. But they also featured Webb spectrum showcases of the galaxy's composition featured in that image. We can detect a lot of different elements in the spectrographic details gleaned from this photo that include, of course, a lot of oxygen and a lot of hydrogen. A little neon shows up too, but of course, if you've got hydrogen and you've got oxygen, then you've got the potential for water too, and thereby you probably also have the potential for life. There was also the atmospheric composition of an exoplanet, WASP 96b, that was detailed in some of the recent imagery. And although this wasn't an actual image captured by the telescope per se, data gleaned from its imaging systems has revealed the abundance of hydrogen and oxygen in the WASP 96b atmosphere. And that's really important because here again, we are looking at an exoplanet transiting a star, which gives us a view of its atmosphere that reveals potentially habitable components. That's really important. Along with these images, we also had new stunning images, and I think that these are some of the most gorgeous of them all, of the Southern Ring Nebula. These images are just incredible, but what's really special about the Webb images is that although astronomers knew there was a binary star at the center of this nebula, the stellar dust that forms the nebula itself actually obscured much of that from view. But that's not the case for Webb because the infrared spectrum allows for these longer wavelengths that are far more easily perceived by the Webb telescope, and so they were able to actually visualize this binary star system in the center of that nebula. Remember, again, I've got this all linked there in the show notes so you guys can look at those and follow along. Hopefully many of you already are. We also had images of what's known as Stefan's Quintet. This actually featured famously in the film It's a Wonderful Life. But this image, I believe, actually the largest collected so far by the Webb team. It was actually a composite image that was assembled from around 1,000 separate smaller images. Yeah, this is one of the largest and definitely one of the most vibrant that Webb has captured. And then finally, they also revealed a really striking image of what's known as the Carina Nebula, which has been described previously by NASA as a billowing cloud of cold interstellar gas and dust rising from a tempestuous stellar nursery. According to Dr. Amber Strawn, who talked about this during this morning's event, she said, "Today, for the first time, we are seeing brand new stars that previously were completely hidden from our view." And one big takeaway, folks, let me tell you, there's a lot of them out there. So indeed, you can see our full coverage over at thedebrief.org, and those are the main highlights, although I do want to add, of course, that during the event this morning, NASA Administrator Bill Nelson spoke with usual excitement about this incredible series of images. Here's what Bill Nelson had to say this morning.
What a banner day. It's clear that Webb represents the best of NASA. It maintains our ability to propel us forward for science, for risk-taking, for inspiration. And we don't want to ever stop exploring the heavens, nor stop daring to take another step forward for humanity. In the words of the famous Carl Sagan, "Somewhere, something incredible is waiting to be known." I think those words are becoming reality.
I've said this in the past. I can't hear Bill Nelson talk and not get excited. It's incredible and it's inspiring to have a NASA administrator who displays such obvious excitement during this incredible time in space exploration. Very glad to have Bill Nelson in there. But speaking of NASA and what they've been up to in recent days, or actually what they will be up to later this year, we had a really interesting opinion piece posted at the Washington Post by their editorial board in recent days titled, "NASA is Right to Examine UFOs." As the WashPo notes in this short editorial piece, NASA isn't saying aliens exist, but it is saying for the first time in almost half a century that UFOs are worth paying attention to. Interesting also that the Washington Post somewhat defiantly continues to use UFOs. Hey, you know what? I support that, because everybody knows what you're talking about. You don't have to explain. But the main thrust of the Washington Post opinion piece here has to do with the previous studies we've seen in recent years, the ODNI report from last summer, and really essentially the very little amount of data that's come out of that. As they note, the outcome of these probes so far has been deflating. The unidentified phenomena remain mostly unidentified. That's precisely why NASA's entrance into the fray with a modest $100,000 study slated to start this fall and last around 9 months is so welcome. They add, the Defense Department and intelligence community have a clear interest in examining, for instance, whether what look like aircraft are advanced technology from a foreign power, perhaps designed for military use or to collect data from the skies, though there's no evidence yet to support that hypothesis. But, as they go on to say, NASA's interests are even broader, and so are its capabilities. NASA can try to answer national security questions too, they note, but, and I think this is the most important takeaway from the WashPo piece here, NASA's focus is on the science, not just on the defense side of this, and they are potentially able to look at a lot of different implications of what UAP might represent, and surely are going to be capable of releasing more of that information to the public. As the WashPo notes in its op-ed, the pursuit will obviously prove worthwhile if NASA or anyone else discovers that aliens do indeed exist, but it will also be worthwhile if, and this is much more likely, researchers land on another explanation for UAPs, and even if they land on no explanation at all. But in short, the WashPo has given its endorsement to NASA's UFO study. Now that said, speaking of Washington, by the way, there was also recent language that appeared online that seems to indicate that the fiscal year 2023 National Defense Authorization Act may include wording that many view as being in the furtherance of transparency on the government's collection of UAP data. And of course, as always, you can follow this story over at thedebrief.org. Sean Munger and Craig Labadie, as usual, doing yeoman's work, helping us keep tabs on what's going on up there in Washington related to UAP. As they note in the article, and I'll provide the main takeaways here for you, the new language proposed for inclusion in next year's bill would mandate that, one, non-disclosure orders and written agreements will not prohibit the disclosure of UAP information to the UAPTF or to the office, that is, of course, its successor, the AOI-MSG, two, that the intelligence community shall establish a system for reporting UAP-related information, regardless of classification level, to the UAPTF or office. And it also includes language calling for the protection of witnesses that share UAP-related information from liability, as well as any retaliation for breaking a non-disclosure agreement. So in other words, if people who have worked in government are coming forward and talking about their knowledge about UAP, this language would essentially offer protections for them. And as is customary, you can find Sean and Craig's article there at The Debrief, linked in the show notes, and you can read all about that. But as far as who introduced this legislation, it is worth mentioning that this actually came courtesy of Representative Mike Gallagher. You may remember him from the recent congressional hearings as being the guy who brought up the 1960s nuclear incident, also the Wilson memo, and he received a lot of attention for doing so. In fact, shortly after the congressional hearings, he spoke with reporters about the small amount of UFO research that he'd done before those hearings, and yet, of course, his big takeaway had been, despite what I had learned in that short amount of time, the folks I'm asking questions about this phenomenon and what the government has learned seem to know less than I did, a point which Representative Gallagher raised when he was speaking with the press shortly after the event, and we have that audio now.
I'm new to this debate. Like, I don't bring particular UAP expertise, but I've done basic research. I've probably done about 5 hours worth of research. So I asked what I thought were basic questions for people that are just modestly familiar with the literature. And they couldn't answer any of those questions. I mean, they're suggesting that there's nothing that the government has done from 1969, when we shut down Operation Blue Book, to when we set up some of these new programs, ATIP. I'm sorry, that doesn't withstand basic scrutiny. I do not believe that at all. And then I asked about the Malmstrom incident in 1967. They seemed not to know what the hell I was talking about. And then finally, I asked about this memo that's been floating around out there. And they also seemed not to know what the heck I was talking about. So the whole thing was incredibly confusing. I'm not sure we got any closer to the truth. And listen, I appreciate this effort to destigmatize the discussion. But until the Defense Department starts speaking in simple and direct, plain English,
yes,
and answering questions, we're just going to spin everybody up, or we're going to be spinning around in circles. So I left very frustrated. And I'll stop here, but though I started off as a casual sort of observer in this whole UAP debate, now I'm so pissed off that I'm not going to let it go until they answer my question.
Now, listen, you know, Representative Gallagher's gotten a lot of pushback, especially from the media, for being the guy who asked what they perceived as being irrelevant questions about all of this. Yes, NASA should study UAP, but Mike Gallagher, you can take your old 1960s incidents and your Project Blue Book files and go back home. Well, for my own part, and maybe I'm the outlier here, but I actually admire Representative Gallagher's attitude. Hey, listen, we have a right, the American people have a right to know what we have collected. Maybe it's time that we start offering a better perspective on that, a fuller picture. We should dive into the old case files. And if there's information that was collected at any time in the past, that too should be a part of what the government reveals about its investigations, not just the stuff collected since 2019. I actually respect that perspective an awful lot, along with his sponsoring of the amendment, as outlined in Craig and Sean's article there for us over at the Debrief. But, you know, Gallagher got some attention in a National Review article in late May by Jack Butler, who noted that appearing on the Pat McAfee show the day after the hearing, Gallagher suggested one possibility that hasn't been considered for unresolved UAP sightings, in addition to foreign adversaries or extraterrestrials, and that is, wait for it, ladies and gentlemen, that they could be our own technology going back in time to our present. According to Gallagher, go back 200 years and you would say, you guys don't have cars, internet, good machine guns, what's going on? So from our point in history, he said, forward 200 years, and whoever's left at that point, if we can avoid nuking ourselves is going to say, wait, you guys can't bend space-time? We figured that out like 50, maybe 100 years ago. Now, of course, on the one hand, I have to chuckle just a little because Representative Gallagher is presenting an idea which is actually pretty out of the box, especially for people who don't spend a whole lot of time studying UAP. It seems like he has recently joined that demographic, people who do spend their time reading about this. But maybe for folks like Jack Butler, writing for National Review, who don't spend a lot of time reading about UFOs, yeah, maybe the idea of time travel from the future really is an all-new, all-different idea. Now, for any similarly interested observers out there, maybe those new to the UAP debate, I will add that I wrote a book back in 2013 titled The UFO Singularity, which did, among other things, look at the time travel component. I think a few people over the years have mistaken that for meaning that that is the one thing Micah thinks these are. If you read The UFO Singularity, it's clear that Hanks believes these are all time travelers from the future. Well, to the contrary, and I think kind of like what Mike Gallagher's saying here, this is a possibility maybe that's worthy of consideration among the range of possibilities that UAP might represent. Again, as the Washington Post editorial board was saying, the most likely explanation is probably something closer to home, closer to Earth. But some would actually say that, well, you know, if visitation from extraterrestrials is so difficult, should we therefore look at time travel as actually being a more likely possibility? After all, that would allow a mechanism through which UAP could technically be from here. They just aren't from here and now, right? And further, I should point out that time travel is something that is technically mathematically possible in terms of our understanding of the universe as Einstein envisioned it with general relativity. So it's not impossible, but is it necessarily more likely than, for instance, extraterrestrials visiting Earth? To that point, I'd have to say that if in the future at any time we could actually harness functional time travel, given the considerations for how that might be done based on our current understanding, and to that point, ladies and gents, I mean, I've read a lot of the brightest thinkers who have looked at this topic over the years, it would be extremely difficult. So to say it's not impossible doesn't mean we can really do it or that it's right around the corner. Maybe at some point in the distant future we will harness that ability, but it's not going to be easy. And so in light of that, to me, if we could ever harness the ability to travel through time, a similarly advanced civilization would probably also be able to overcome the current problems we see with distant space travel. So to me, I don't really see time travel as a better explanation for the kinds of technologies we may be seeing in the here and now. It is merely one possibility. That's all it is. But fundamentally, either in the case of time travel or visitation to Earth by distant extraterrestrials, either of those possibilities, as far as UAP is concerned, would have to represent a highly advanced civilization. In the case of time travel, that could be a future version of us. In the case of aliens, well, maybe they've just been around longer than we have. But, in truth, explaining UAP may not even involve leaping to the conclusion that somebody, us in the future, or somebody else further out there actually is more technologically advanced than we are. I mean, can we necessarily say that UAP technologies are so far advanced beyond the known of today that we have to lead with a presumption that no known technologies, that no current understanding of science can account for these objects? You know, maybe we don't need to presume that they must be something exotic, either from our future or from someplace really far away. Maybe we should exhaust the possibilities nearer to home and nearer to now before we go in that direction. Last quick point I'll make on the UAP subject before we get into this conversation with Randall Nickerson. Of course, in recent days, we have seen the 75th anniversary of the famous Roswell incident of 1947. Now, of course, there's a bit of division about when exactly we should celebrate that anniversary, because some would say, well, you know, the headline appeared on July 8th, 1947 in the Roswell Daily Record, so that's the anniversary. Some would also say, yeah, but the crash actually occurred at a different date. And for those who are particularly well-read on the Roswell subject, you'll know that rancher Mac Brazel, who was the discoverer of the wreckage there on his remote ranch outside of Roswell, actually really closer to the town of Corona. But that notwithstanding, he actually discovered this debris several weeks earlier, sometime in June, and he kind of sweeps up some of it and tucks it away under some brush and forgets about it until he goes into town a few weeks later. It's a Saturday night. He has no telephone. He has no radio out there at his ranch. Gosh, talk about the old days. I wish sometimes I had fewer telephones and radios around here. But Brazel goes into town, and then he hears the news. He sees the newspapers. All of this hysteria about these flying saucers. And Brazel thinks, now what in the world is all this about? And then it dawns on him, wait, what if one of these things is what crashed out there on my ranch? What if I have found a flying saucer? And so he goes to the local sheriff in the town of Roswell, George Wilcox, and he brings some of this debris down there, and then Wilcox contacts Roswell Army Airfield, and thereafter, the intelligence officer at the base, Jesse Marcel, comes out. He goes back with Brazel to the ranch. They look at some more of this debris, and then shortly thereafter, the Roswell Daily Record learns about this story, and it leads with this headline on July 8th about the Air Force capturing a flying saucer on this remote ranch. Only one day later, mind you, to update the story and now say, well, it turns out that flying disc was in fact just a weather balloon. No story here at all. And it was largely forgotten after that. In fact, in 1967, researcher Ted Bletcher, in his report on the UFO wave of 1947, he listed the Roswell incident as a misinterpretation within a section about misinterpretations and hoaxes. And Bletcher said this was entirely just the result of a bunch of journalists printing a sensational headline before they had all the facts. No flying saucer was recovered. Well, many years later, Stanton Friedman runs into Jesse Marcel. He's doing a television interview. I think it's about 1978 or 79. But this producer says, listen, there's this guy here in town named Jesse Marcel, and you should talk to him because he says that he's actually seen a crashed flying disc and that he saw the debris back in the 1940s. Now, this naturally piqued the interest of Stanton Friedman because stories about crash wreckage retrievals of UFOs had been in circulation since at least the late 1940s. They were popularized beginning in the early 1950s by authors like Frank Scully, and these associated with an alleged crash that occurred at Aztec, New Mexico. And for years thereafter, that one, by the way, was shown to have been a hoax, but for years thereafter, and even still today, there are some who try to champion the idea that no, the Aztec case was the real crash. Others said it occurred at Socorro, some said it was Corona. Others said it was just somewhere in the Southwest, and that it hadn't been located anywhere near any of those locales, but that there was a crash that recurred, we just can't seem to get all the facts on it. Well, this burgeoning mythos of a crash wreckage retrieval that had been kind of building since the 1950s really started coming to a head in the late 70s when Marcel comes forward and tells Friedman, yeah, I saw this, and it was no kind of aircraft that we recognized. Then his colleague, William Moore, co-authored a book that was published in 1980, co-authored with American author Charles Berlitz, titled The Roswell Incident. The rest, at that point, became history, a long-forgotten UFO incident, which in fact was long suspected not of even involving a UFO, suddenly has new life breathed into it. And it became the biggest sensation in ufology of the 20th century. It really did. And that even despite the fact that two Air Force reports in the late 1990s concluded that the entire Roswell story actually had been a cover-up, but not of a flying saucer crash. No, this actually involved a top-secret mogul balloon. That had been the story that they offered. Now, a lot of ufologists, they didn't buy that story. Many today still don't. And I got a lot of colleagues who don't like it when I say that the most likely explanation, in my view, is actually the Mogul scenario or something similar to it. Although there are some who would maintain that in fact the data actually shows that there shouldn't have been a Mogul balloon there in the vicinity at that time. And there have been a number of researchers who have endorsed that view, chief among them Kevin Randall, who was on the program last year and talked about that very point. But the big takeaway really for Roswell, 75 years in as we are, is that opinions about it remain as divided as they ever have been at any time. And I tried to encapsulate some of the biggest takeaways from the Roswell debate in a recent article I did over there at The Debrief, which, of course, as always, you can find linked there in the show notes. I don't know, what are your thoughts about the infamous Roswell incident of 1947? Is this indeed still the UFO smoking gun many have been looking for, and many maintain that it is? Or is this actually probably just one of those case-closed situations that we now have the explanation, and we should just move on and look for better data? What do you guys think? Tweet at me, at Micah Hanks on Twitter. You can also email me, info@MicahHanks.com. I do still get a lot of emails from you guys out there, and one day soon, I promise we're going to get to some of those emails, which have been building up over time, but a few of you have written in and said, I don't know if you read emails on the show anymore. I do from time to time, so you're welcome to email me there at info@MicahHanks.com. Now, it's about time for us to get into this conversation with Randall Nickerson, but before we do, I do have to tell you about our next partner, who has a product that I literally use every day. You've heard me talk about Athletic Greens, and that's because Athletic Greens is my chosen multivitamin supplement that I take every day. It helps me kickstart my energy levels at the start of every day, and one thing I really love about it is that you just tear open a packet, pour it in a glass of water, stir it, you drink it, and you're ready to go. I personally like to take Athletic Greens right before I exercise because it does kind of give you an energy kick. But I also found when I started taking it a few months ago that it really helped me sleep better at night. I've been using it for months now, and I gotta tell you, I really love it. And one thing that really helps with that is the fact that, frankly, it tastes fantastic. You guys have even tweeted at me in recent weeks talking about how good it tastes. I told you so, and I hope that indeed more of you guys will try it in the days ahead because you're gonna be absorbing, when you do, 75 high-quality vitamins, minerals, whole food-sourced superfoods, probiotics, and adaptogens. They're gonna help you start your day right. It is a key blend of ingredients that's going to support gut health, it's going to help with your nervous system, it's going to boost your immune system, it's going to boost your energy levels, your recovery, your focus, and also help stave off the effects of aging. All these things in one affordable package. All that in addition to being lifestyle friendly and also supporting a lot of causes that are important to me, like being a climate neutral certified company, and also in addition to purchasing carbon credits that support projects protecting old growth rainforests, Athletic Greens also contributes a lot to charities like No Kid Hungry right here in the United States. For every purchase, they donate to organizations that help to keep nutritious food on plates and in front of kids and families that need them. So listen, guys, right now it's time to reclaim your health and arm your immune system with convenient daily nutrition. No need for a million different pills and supplements. You can do it efficiently and inexpensively. And to make it even more easy, Athletic Greens is going to give you a free one-year supply of immune-supporting vitamin D and five of those free travel packs with your first purchase. And all you've got to do to sign up today is visit athleticgreens.com/Micah. Again, that's athleticgreens.com/Micah, athleticgreens.com/MICAH to take ownership over your health and pick up the ultimate daily nutritional insurance. Alrighty, ladies and gents, and with all of the housekeeping out of the way, Randall Nickerson is going to be joining us here in a moment to talk about this incredible new documentary that he has produced about the aerial school phenomenon. What did children in Zimbabwe witness, and why is this perhaps one of the most important UFO cases of all time? Randall's going to tell us all about it when we return here in a moment, right here on the Micah Hanks program.
Thank you.
Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks Program, and this week we're going to be diving into quite a story, one that occurred on September 16th, 1994, involving 62 students at Ariel School in Zimbabwe, who all witnessed something incredible and something that has also impacted many of their lives, and that's ongoing until this very day. All of this, of course, outlined in a recent documentary about the incident. In fact, I saw this incredible film recently, and the filmmaker, of course, is here with us right now to discuss this. This is arguably one of the best films, one of the best made films, I think, too, about the UFO phenomenon and the important story, the testimony provided by those who have had first-hand experiences with it. And Randall Nickerson is the filmmaker and documentarian in question who traveled to Zimbabwe and other locations in order to fully document this story on camera, and he joins me right now. Randall, my friend, how are you?
Hey, very good. Thanks for having me on. Very good introduction. It's really precise.
You and I finally got to catch up very briefly at the SCU event down there in Alabama, and that was a lot of fun. The strangest thing to me was that I think everybody was more thrilled by who was in attendance. People like yourself who were just, you know, attendees at the conference. It ended up being quite a who's who of ufology.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. Yeah, that I really believe the phenomena, the main information is going to be coming out of that particular conference.
Yeah.
It's just that, I mean, the people that are involved are the kind of people I want to be around, which is, you know, science and defense people, you know, essentially that's who's there. A lot of science people. And that's exactly how this problem needs to be addressed.
Yeah, I completely agree. Of course, on the other side of that, there are the, you know, the journalists, there are the filmmakers, people like ourselves who one day, if we're lucky, what we present on this topic, I think, will be what historians go back to and look at and say, you know, it took a while for us to get to that point of recognition, but the information was all there. And to me, fundamentally, Randall, that's what you've done with this new film. I do want to ask you, what is it about this story right here at the outset that grabbed you the way that it did? And you have, I mean, spent several years, maybe more than that, you know, documenting this story. What was it about this one in particular that grabbed you and made you want to get involved?
14 years. The initial interviews, you know, the archival interviews that I started to watch. I'm like, these kids are telling the truth. Their body language, you know, there were just so many subtle cues. That's what got me. I mean, really. And also a bit of compassion, like, oh my God, I believe they actually went through this. And so what does that mean? And how hard was that for them as a collective group? That got me fascinated for sure. And then when you talk to all the other people that were involved, the reporters, John Mack, Cynthia Hind, all these people, and how this story affected their lives. I was like, wow, whatever, regardless of what happened there, in a way, wow, did it have a profound effects on people's lives? So it was kind of weird to just be, you know, following this story, not really. I mean, I know these people now, but, you know, studying an event in another country that, is just, yeah, it was very motivating, and I felt a responsibility to tell it well, you know, to tell as much as I could find out in the way it happened.
Yeah, which led you to track down some of the participants who, of course, are grown up now. We'll talk more about them here in a moment, but I mean, you also traveled there and you document a lot of their real-life reactions returning to the location of this incident after all these years. That in itself must have been formative for you as well, maybe transformative, in fact.
Yeah, in a way. It was just an honor to have been there in that moment, to see how people were affected by that, and to see that it was real as well, you know, very much. Yeah, I went to Zimbabwe 3 times, and that was our final trip. But yeah, I spent a good amount of time over in Africa and, you know, just working on this story, but also witnessing where this happened in a very, very different land compared to people on the northern, in the northern, northwest.
Yeah. You know, I do want to back up here for a moment, since we're close to the beginning of this conversation, and just ask you, you know, as far as your own background in filmmaking, you know, how did you become involved as a filmmaker, and did that precede your UFO interest, or was it the other way around?
That's a really good question. I think the reason I got into the entertainment industry to begin with, around film and music, really was because I had experienced something I could not express, basically.
Yeah.
I'd seen something myself that I could not, that didn't fit, and people just didn't seem to understand at all or have any knowledge of. So I think that's the honest answer to that. You know, I was in all different aspects of theater and directing and, you know, camera, sound recording, you know, I was doing every little job. And then I was present in New York City on September 11th. I was two blocks north of the towers.
Wow.
And it was that moment in time. I'd already started making some short films, but it was that moment in particular, because I was filming at the time, that I just, you know, that's when I decided that's what I need to do, is tell other people's stories.
Yeah. See, that's interesting to me that you describe how your own personal experiences, it's almost like cathartic in a way. You're pushed toward art because it gives you maybe some sort of expression, some sort of a medium through which you can express, if not your own feelings and your own experiences that defy explanation, you can help somebody else tell their stories maybe.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I think that happens with a lot of people in the arts. You feel that there are things that happen in your life that are very hard to, no matter what it is, that are either hard to share with anybody else, or the only way to express it is through the piano. For me, it's the piano, or in through a photograph, or, you know, some type of something art, you know, an art piece, or a performance piece. Because there are so many things you just can't express in words and logical. There are a lot of things that are not logical in our world.
You're telling me.
We never talk about.
Yeah. Well, you know, it is interesting because the UFO phenomenon is something that sort of defies that logic that we all expect. You know, our expectations for the, you know, consensus reality we all share and what we expect to encounter in it. Now, in this incident in 1994, several children had that kind of experience where they saw something that, you know, most people would ridicule them for talking about. Can we go back to the very beginning and describe those events, the sequence of events, what happens, how that story plays out, and how people become involved in this story making its way out into the mainstream?
Well, it started with several different reports around Zimbabwe. You know, I don't know who knew about what at that time, to be honest, because it really didn't get the serious attention it deserved until the aerial school. Mm-hmm. So people had seen things in the sky more than a few times that were not normal. I mean, there's nobody that will question that was that these things were moving and making turns and things like that. And then on the day of aerial, which was the 16th, children had seen these things in the sky first. They were all at play, you know, all on break. And then the teachers were in a staff meeting. And then this silver thing, which had been seen in the sky before, you know, minutes before that, set down or hovered outside of the playground. That's when people started to gather to look and see what it was, you know, it just gathered a lot of attention. And, they watched this thing, you know, it could, it would sometimes appear, disappear, front of their eyes, and then they'd see it again, and then they saw these creatures emerge from it. You know, in the beginning, just to lay out something that I haven't really laid out before, but there were initial reports of four. That's new because I haven't really talked about it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it wasn't the predominant, you know, most of them saw two. Some of them saw one, but the initial reports, like from the beginning of the archival footage, there were reports of four. What happened to the other two? Because they're not described, you know, later on in the interviews. I don't know. But there are definitely, you know, the one that everybody had contact with, that was a very specific thing. And there were probably more than, I mean, there was definitely more than one for sure. But I can put out confidently that I think there really were four initially.
And we're talking about the occupants, right? The occupants. Okay. Of that
object. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they reported it. They had an incident with it as it approached the school. And there was eye contact between them and it. And there was some type of, it was all strange. If you talk to any of the witnesses, that it was all just very weird. Energies and ways of communication that were just not possible, you know, in our perspective or their perception. And then they all got very anxious because of the sound that this thing made a couple different times, but the last time it really scared all the kids, and they all went running into the, you know, 100 kids into the staff office to tell them.
Yeah, I mean, it's a striking encounter, and the way that they describe the humanoids is very interesting. I do want to remind people, by the way, that in the film that Randall directed and produced, you'll be able to see a lot of the artistic renderings that the children provided. Now, for the listener, as we engage through the theater of the mind, how would you describe most of the descriptions of the occupants that the children said that they saw?
Short, you know, 3.5. One child says, you know, 3.5 feet. And the other, you know, we'll say, oh, it was the size of a sixth grader, you know, not an adult size, skinny body, large head, large eyes. And, you know, this is the description that's over 90% of the world reports the same exact thing. But I got to say, for Zimbabwe, they didn't, you know, the things they reported weren't the typical things I would expect, you know, different color, but the same dynamics, the same types of, you know, like in their descriptions, they describe these huge eyes as like rugby balls, you know, things uh-huh. they could relate to.
Sure.
So the language is different, and the way of describing it is different, slightly, you know, it's not part of our media craziness over here about UFOs and flying saucers, which is refreshing, actually.
It is. Well, I think it's really useful to get a, you know, different cultural perspective on this. You know, I've seen some skeptics try to argue that we see a phenomenon in UFOs that is exclusive to North America and especially the United States, and that it may occur in other parts of the English-speaking world, but for the most part, you know, people don't have this experience outside of the English-speaking world. And again, having spent time, when I saw your film, Randall, I was in Brazil, and I had been meeting with politicians, with researchers, you know, with other people who are, you know, in the community and who are very interested in this, and there's a rich history. You know, I had my friend Tony, in fact, told me an incredible story about a landed craft that was observed on his mother's property as recently as 2011. But the point being, you know, people around the world do describe these phenomena. There are sometimes differences in the way that they are described, but the phenomenon seems to have a much more global presence. And again, that's what's important to me, in part, about this case from Zimbabwe, is that, again, it's a very credible case, multiple witnesses. And of course, this seems to document something that is similar to the way it is described in other parts of the world. And of course, we are talking with Randall Nickerson, who is the man behind this new documentary. He is a filmmaker extraordinaire, and it has documented the story of those who had this experience in 1994 with something uncanny, something they could not explain. And we're going to look a little more deeply at the aerial school phenomenon and discuss the film with Randall when we come back right here on the Micah Hanks Program. Welcome back. It is the Micah Hanks Program. My guest this week, Randall Nickerson, is the filmmaker who has recently produced a documentary on the aerial school phenomenon, an incident from 1994, and one that, of course, drew the attention of the late Harvard psychologist John Mack. We'll get into all of that and his involvement in this landmark case here in just a bit. But first, I want to remind you, if you aren't already an X subscriber, you're only getting half of the story because every week we send along an additional edition, a separate dispatch, which is supplemental to the main program, featuring additional commentary from our guests, additional original investigations into strange phenomena that we discuss here on the program, and of course we also have the monthly Enigmas special, which goes out once a month. We are, gosh, I mean, there are dozens and dozens of episodes now, and all of that, of course, is delivered to you when you become a subscriber via your own unique RSS feed. It's just $7 a month or $77 a year, so you can find the link to where you can sign up right there in the show notes or at MicahHanks.com/podcast. And with that, it's time for us to get back into this conversation. Randall, you know, something else you mentioned right there, Randall, has to do with other details about these beings or occupants that differed. What exactly are you talking about? Was it skin color, clothing, what else?
One of the things that differed was they were in black. That was not a common description in any of the historical. I mean, it is in two other cases that I'm aware of, and a third potentially, and where they're dressed in that particular tight-fitting black uniform of some kind. I mean, I just don't know where that would have come from. Do you know what I mean? Looking at, like, if let's say they made up a story, like they'd want to, you know, make it consistent. Well, that's what really brings a lot of truth to this story, is there's a lot of things, and there was no question they were telling the truth about it. There's some just so many specifics. I mean, the way they behaved, the way they moved, the way they held themselves, that isn't even in the movie, but it's very telling in comparison to other cases. And the cases are all over. Every single country has a case. There's no question about that. We're just not talking about it.
Right.
You know, yeah, it's all over.
I recall Aimé Michel, the famous French researcher who had documented some of those early landings and humanoid sightings. I mean, well in advance of that becoming something that was a popular motif within ufology in the United States. But just to say that there's a deeper history that goes back, that described things that were very similar. In terms of some of those behaviors you're describing, you know, one of the school children had said that it looked like the man was kind of running back and forth, and that almost like at times, and I don't want to mix and match descriptions, but another description perhaps also said that they appeared to kind of zip in and out of perception or maybe existence. Can you describe some of those unique behaviors that were associated with the way that these individuals, these occupants, seem to behave or appear?
Well, it went on for, according to students and the headmaster, for about 15 minutes. So there was a lot of things that could be observed in that period of time, you know what I mean? But definitely there were some, it's just consistently reported, like some kind of time dilation or time manipulation in some way. I'm not a professional about that. I do know gravity affects time. but you know, that's, there's definitely some bizarre stuff that people saw, like one, you know, a creature going across the field and then disappearing, and it's starting at the same place it started before, you know, when it was first seen. Mm-hmm. Like, it's almost like Matrix stuff, or, you know, where you see the cat and you see the cat, you know, repeating. I mean, that's crazy. So what are we dealing with? And it was reported by so many different kids that, okay, that I can assume that really happened. So what is that? I mean, these are the questions that science community needs to answer. You know, other people need to start looking at this stuff in a way like, okay, how would that be possible? You know, if these reports are true, then we need to start looking at what's reported and what that means. And I think it all connects, to be honest with you. I think on some level, the physics makes sense with what's occurring. If we assume that these physics are much more complex and somebody else has figured things out that we haven't.
Yeah. I agree. Yeah, again, there may be clues in there. I like the Matrix reference, too, because going through all the different possibilities, I've looked at everything. I'm sure you have, too, Randall. You know, I mean, time travelers, actual extraterrestrial biological entities, AI. But I also enjoy, although I never marry myself to any theory, I enjoy the idea that, you know, maybe from time to time, the phenomenon that we encounter is what it's like when the operators interface with the Matrix and we see them for a while, and then you get those weird little hiccups in space-time. But in any case, whatever it represents, I think you're right. Some of these observations may give us clues about what the phenomenon is, where it comes from, and what it means. That's one more reason I'm also interested in communication. And some of the children also claim to have perceived, if not directly heard, things, messages, I suppose, coming from some of the occupants. Can we discuss that a bit?
Yeah, they, as far as I know, from all the witnesses I've talked to, is that it was pictures. You know, it wasn't something that was verbally communicated. I have not heard that. But it was about, it was pictures of our own environment. Mm-hmm. You know, what we were doing to our own environment here, which was kind of odd. You know, in 1994. And it just showed what we were doing to our planet, and without any solution or anything like that. So, and how that was communicated is really interesting, because these kids didn't understand how that was possible, that a creature could somehow communicate with you through your mind. And, you know, a lot of the kids, they talked to my conscience. They, you know, I mean, there was struggling to even describe what happened. It is a whole nother ball game, a whole nother part of this phenomenon too, that's also reported globally. So there's a lot to unwrap.
There certainly is. You know, again, if this does represent some sort of a nonverbal telepathic communication or anything similar to that, that also may be a clue as to what we're dealing with. You know, some would say, okay, if you were an extraterrestrial intelligence and you're going to go to a planet and you're going to touch down, you're going to make contact, who would you go and look for? And if indeed this is a true story, why not politicians? Why not the White House lawn? Why not, you know, science leaders? Why are they going and showing themselves to kids? Now, first of all, there's a lot of presumptions in that kind of a scenario. You know, who says that these intelligences want to be seen necessarily? But, you know, one way I would look at this, Randall, is they're showing these messages to the next generation, not people who have their own biases or own skepticism, or who are going to, you know, who may even doubt what they saw. Not people who have their own ideas about the environment, but the next generation that's going to carry that message with them as they grow and learn and develop and they mature. And in a way, you know, with your film coming out, it kind of brings this message out. And you see that these children did just that. They've carried this sort of idea, this concept that there was something going on and that maybe we as humans should be more aware of our environment and how we treat it. They seem to have carried this with them throughout their lives. Would you agree that that's a fair assessment, that most of the children you spoke with seem to convey that?
I think it's on their mind. I think, every person's different in how they're processing it and how they think about it. So that's an individual thing. But it's definitely a lot of thought going now that the movie's out. I'm sure for them, it's rather brings a lot up for them. And that's definitely one of the things for sure. I mean, I found that with people that didn't want to go on camera, that they had received these messages and they didn't want to talk about that because it sounded so strange. You know, like all of this, they're afraid to be ridiculed. And thankfully, that's hopefully changing, where we can actually have these conversations and figure out what's going on, really. I mean, that's really what we need to be doing, figuring out what is going on here, because it's important.
Yeah, well, I agree. But now, you spoke to many more witnesses than who would go on camera, and they seem to convey both the consistency in terms of the narrative, but also their concerns about the stigma that have, you know, really these stigmas that have prevailed against this topic for decades.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah,
that's definitely really,
I understand it. And it's just, yeah, it's, I empathize with them, you know, just that's hard. But I just hope the whole subject matter is changing a bit so we can have the proper people look at this and get to the point.
Yeah.
What that is, because I think we're wasting time. The longer we're not looking at this, the more I get concerned.
Me too. You know, and what you described there, Randall, I mean, it kind of, I can relate to that in the sense that everything I do professionally, the more that we see come out about this subject, I feel like all those things are tangent or you know, secondary, I should say, to, you know, my main goal, which is just, and if I had the time, if I had the resources, I would spend almost all my time, if not all my time, looking at this topic. I mean, that's how important this is. I want to come over to a few of the key players in this story that are featured in your documentary. The first, I guess, really that deserves mention here, Emily Trim, you know, the young lady who actually travels back to Africa. She revisits the location. She sees some of her old schoolmasters. And she's gone through a real transformative experience, which I'm always fascinated when someone expresses their own personal transformations through art. And she really does that. And that is conveyed beautifully in your film. Can we talk about Emily and her involvement a bit?
Yeah, she's a brilliant artist. I watched her for a long period of time of just, you know, she would just paint every day. And she would be driven to paint. Like it was pretty incredible. She's extremely passionate. That's how I, you know, she gets her things gets things out. And she does some beautiful work.
Yeah, she's just a tremendous talent. But, you know, she also seems like a person who is very, even though she's obviously gone through a transformative experience, that much seems to be conveyed in the film. She also seems extremely well-grounded in terms of having known what she experienced, having the, I think it's fair to say, bravery to go back and to chase the past and to revisit the memories of these experiences with some of the people that she had known at the time. What was that like? Being the person, you know, operating the camera, following her on that personal journey and sharing in that experience of her revisiting something that, again, still defies explanation for she and everybody else who saw it.
It was just amazing to watch it unfold in real time and watch people's reactions and watch her reactions and how it was talked about amongst themselves, and just to be the fly on the wall, so to speak, was really fascinating. And to realize, wow, this did have an impact on a lot of people. And yeah, she was extremely brave to do that. And it didn't change my view, you know, at all. It just reinforced, like, wow, yeah, this had lasting impacts on a lot of people's lives. And it was an honor to be able to witness that, to be honest.
Do you feel like Emily and some of her former, you know, schoolmates, that they had a unique bond, and that after all these years still showed as a result of what they experienced together?
I think the bond, I mean, you know, everybody's different and they have different groups of friends, and it's something that, it's like when you experience a car accident with somebody, or hopefully not, but, you know, right. or some other huge event. I mean, you're connected in that way forever. I mean, when you're 90, you'll be able to remember that time, you know, you just, it connects you in a way that it'll never change. You'll always know that person. People that were at September 11th when I was there, I mean, I remember every single person that was in my life at that time, and we'll never forget that moment because we were all there.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's that kind of thing. So it's actually interesting because you find it in other people that talk about or have had experiences of this magnitude like this. You'll find that same kind of behavior. It's like they're friends for their whole lives, but they don't talk about it too much.
Right.
Because it's actually pretty disturbing. Yeah. So that I find you wouldn't think that, you know, normally, but that's really what I've seen over and over. And it's like, wow, that's very interesting. It makes sense. It's not like you're talking with each other about something that we understand.
Right.
Like that's part of the problem, you know?
Well, again, keeping with your car accident analogy. Yeah. I mean, that's something you'll never forget, but it's disturbing. It's not the kind of thing you ever want to have to go through again. And, that seems to be kind of the running theme with these kinds of encounters. People who see this sort of thing, everybody says, oh, wow, if this is real, I'd give anything to have that encounter. But talk to the people who actually have. Many are frightened. Many are disturbed. Many have a problem relating to other people because they feel like they're different as a result of what they experienced. And that's definitely something that you find in a lot of these UFO landing cases among people who have had these experiences. As Randall Nickerson has documented in his film, The Aerial School Phenomenon, we're going to wrap up this conversation about that film with Randall when we come back here in a moment. It is the Micah Hanks Program. More awaits on the other side of this break. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Rounding out this conversation with Randall Nickerson about his documentary, The Aerial School Phenomenon. And he has really gone to a lot of trouble, painstakingly so, traveling with some of the witnesses, going to Zimbabwe, interviewing those who were original participants at the time this happened, and of course also collecting archival footage featuring the late Harvard psychiatrist John Mack and looking at his involvement in this case. But arguably another one of the unsung heroes in this is Tim Leach, who is a celebrated war reporter who also found his way into the middle of the fray regarding this case. Randall, could you tell us about Tim Leach and his involvement?
I think the most fascinating thing was he had a journey. You know, he got on the scene, didn't believe the kids. You know, he felt they saw a helicopter. I mean, he says it in a lot of the interviews. He's asking the kids, are you sure it wasn't a helicopter? Are you sure it wasn't? He couldn't believe that the kids were actually telling him what they actually saw. So, but over time, you know, he kept going back to the school and they kept saying the same thing. And so he went on a journey of like, oh my God, is this real? And then he, you know, filed it with the BBC, knew he was taking a risk. So yeah, he had his own journey of, you know, from disbelief to belief to consequences for those beliefs, you know, or just reporting the story, to be honest, because that's all he did was report the story.
Yeah.
Well,
he did what any journalist should do. And yet, I think for the first time, probably in his career, or at least separate from any other story he ever reported on, I mean, he was met with this, you're doing what you're doing. You're collecting facts, you're reporting, and yet, you know, this is just too incredible to be taken right. as you're reporting it. I mean, that must have been difficult for him too, I would imagine.
Yeah. I mean, he would when we sat and we spent a lot of time together, and when I finally found him, and you know, he said there's a lot of stories that never make the news, and you know, he said that's a shame because a lot of the really hard truths never make, you know, don't get shown to the public. This is back in the 90s, and we're seeing those things today more so, like the pictures that came out of Ukraine, and my thoughts and feelings to those people, because that's really brutal. But those are the pictures they would never show on TV back in the 90s. But it's that kind of thing, you know, there is a little bit of control over the media, so to speak, as far as what they think is appropriate to show us.
Yeah, that's certainly, well, you know, and again, talking about stigmas, appropriateness of addressing this topic and the like, that's exemplified with John Mack, the late John Mack, and his involvement in this case. Again, he traveled to Zimbabwe. He met with and interviewed the children. John's a unique case because here we had a guy who had nothing to gain apart from personal wisdom, maybe, you know, his own interest in exploring what seemed like, you know, virgin territory for psychology or science in general, with his involvement with the UFO subject. He had everything to lose, however, in terms of personal credibility, you know, in terms of you know, his livelihood even. And yet John went there, both literally and figuratively, which makes his involvement in the Ariel School situation just fascinating. You knew John Mack, did you not?
Yeah, I did. That's correct. Yeah. I think I met him in 1991. Yeah, it was late 91. Yeah, I mean, he took, to me, like, watching him, he sort of took the hero's journey and put everything at risk, not out of his personal belief system, but out of, seeing clients, seeing people, and going to these people that have had extraordinary experiences and, documenting what they were saying. And he found consistencies in these same stories, including Ariel and hundreds of others. And he did take a huge risk. And at the time, the institutions were not ready for that. And I understand that. I guess it's a tough one to swallow. Yeah, I mean, the man was brilliant. He had nothing to prove to anyone. He had written many books. He won the Pulitzer Prize. He did a lot of good in his life. He started the Cambridge Hospital psychiatric unit. I mean, he was a superstar.
He was a fascinating guy. And again, a highly respected professional until he decides to embrace the unknown. And then he goes through this sort of inquisition where there's this review by the folks there at Harvard about, you know, his involvement with this topic, which, of course, is covered somewhat in the film also. Could you tell us a little about that, too, Randall?
Yeah, they went and tried to take his tenure away and basically try to, you know, shut him down, or that was the threat. And then he had to get an attorney, and there was this whole battle back and forth. And, you know, then finally Harvard said, well, okay, you know, they dropped everything. But what actually happened there was they managed to ruin his reputation amongst the university at which he worked.
Yeah.
And that was the goal. I saw that as the goal, and it was very evident that that was accomplished. Because all they had to do was raise all kinds of questions, which I could understand it, but the fact that it was done in such a public way, it's interesting. There's a lot of people that I'm sure have a lot of feelings about that could speak about it from a legal perspective, being involved with the case, or in some other perspective. There are plenty of doctors at Harvard who agreed with Dr. Mack, and those people should be speaking as well.
Yes, I agree. You know, again, this comes back for me to you and I being down there at the SCU event in Alabama, and hear all these scientists, you hear all these defense experts and people, you know, from different, very diverse backgrounds. I wish that John Mack were still alive. I guarantee he would have been there. He would have been at an event like that if he had been able to. And if he, Yeah, if he were still around. And I mean, you know, for guys like you and I who are looking at this saying, you know, it's high time science takes this seriously. It's high time that we are seeing more people who are, you know, credible, credentialed scientists getting involved and trying to unravel this. You know, John's always going to be recognized as a guy, whether he was right about all his perceptions of the phenomena. You know, you see people who have their criticisms of John. Well, yeah, he was also operating early on in the game, you know.
Sure.
He was an innovator. That's always the case for the first people who are on the field, so to speak. They don't see everything that's happening, but everybody who comes behind him has a clearer picture, and they build on that work, and John laid a lot of that groundwork. So it's tragic that he's not here to see some of the renewed scientific attention that we're getting right now. Would you agree?
I would agree, and you know, Dr. Mack set up a conference about this at MIT back in 1992 about this very topic, very issue. And that was a big deal. I mean, that involved Harvard, MIT. I mean, I don't know why people don't understand how big of a deal that conference was. But I mean, things were happening back then that he was responsible for as well. And finally, we're still dealing with this same thing, bringing science in.
Yeah.
And really, how do we wrap our heads around it? And you know, I think we're getting to the point where we actually might be able to, you know, technologically, we're growing like crazy and understanding things in science that we never did before. So it may be a time, this may be the right time, but, Dr. Mack, contributed an enormous amount to it, and, to see it being out in SCU and just even from the first time I went there in 2019 to see where it's come to today, I'm pretty excited that we've got the right people finally looking at this, and it needs to be taken out of the, you know, the magic medicine back, you know, in the medical world. Remember, there was all these potions people were sending, you know.
Yeah.
And then we finally got like, okay, let's get to the science of medicine. And I think that's hopefully what we're seeing here. We're finally getting the doctors and the scientists involved to say, all right, let's figure this out. And I'm glad. It's about time.
Yeah, it really is.
It's going to help us grow as a species. I mean, that's the positive part, is we're just going to learn things, and that's great. We don't even understand if there is a negative part, really, other than the fact that there's something there.
The negative to me, Randall, could come from the fact that it's something we don't understand. And of course, you know, you always fear the unknown, but even those things you fear the most, you can learn from. Before we kind of wind things down here, if I may ask you, I'm really interested in knowing a little about how you knew John Mack, how you came to know him, you know, what degree, you know, you two had interactions, you know, how did you know him?
I knew him because I had had an encounter myself, and I was trying to find the best person in the world to be able to talk to about it.
I think you found him.
I did find him. I found others because I was, you know, I was I mean, I was like a very well-known football player in my town. I had a successful career, and then boom, you know. So I wanted to find the best person to either tell me I was crazy or to tell me whatever. I didn't even care, to be honest. I just wanted to explain what I saw and you know, hopefully nobody else had seen it, but that's wasn't the case. So that's how I got to know the man. And I just want to make sure, because, you know, I'm an artist, I'm a director now, and like I've been making films for a while, but no, this is my first feature. But it worries me when I talk about it, because I don't want to be put into the category of, oh, he went through, you know. No, actually, I'm a filmmaker, a pianist, and I have a lot of other things that I do, and this does not say who I am. Mm-hmm. It's just something I had seen. But that's how I met Dr. Mack.
I appreciate the way that you phrase that, and that you don't want to take away from the story you're telling, the work that you're doing, the art that you're presenting. I'm a musician like yourself. I don't know if you know that, but you know, I'm a guitar player and singer too. So we're going to have to play. Right. We're going to have to jam sometime, but I can relate and I really respect your approach to all that. And so I do want to thank you again for joining me and being my guest. And we'll certainly have you back sometime in the future.
Thank you so much. And great questions, sir. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, Randall. And of course, as always, we will feature some additional commentary for X subscribers this week on similar cases to that of the Zimbabwe incident of 1994. To me, there are quite a few that deserve attention. Remember, folks, this phenomenon didn't begin in 2019 or even 2017 when the New York Times started taking it seriously. No, there is indeed a deeper history, one that we examine every week here on the Micah Hanks program. You can follow my work at MicahHanks.com. Follow me on Twitter at Micah Hanks. And, of course, the original reporting of yours truly, Tim McMillan, MJ Benias, Chris Plain, Chrissy Newton, and many others over at thedebrief.org. That wraps it up for this week's edition of the podcast. As always, thanks to all of you for being here and being along for the ride. And you guys, stay strange out there. We'll catch you next time.